Why do we have prisons? Are they for retribution or rehabilitation? Today on River to River, we look at how Iowa's prisons compare to prisons nationwide. Sitting in for Ben Kiefer, I'm Sarah McCammon. This summer, Iowa Public Radio is taking an in-depth look at corrections in Iowa. We began today on Morning Edition with a look at the treatment of sex offenders and continued on Talk of Iowa with a discussion on the history of Iowa's prison system. Now, River to River takes a look at the philosophy behind it all. What is prison for? And how does Iowa's approach to corrections compare to prisons in other states? The purpose of prisons coming up right after this news. You're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Sarah McCammon, in for Ben Kiefer. Today, as we kick off our summer series on Iowa's correctional system, we're beginning by looking at the purpose of prison. Should prison be punitive or rehabilitative? What do Iowans expect from the prisons their tax dollars support? And how is our system different from the rest of the country? Our first guest today is going to give us a look at how another state operates its prisons to set the stage for this conversation. Things are done a little bit differently in Colorado. So Republican State Senator Greg Brophy joins me now. He represents Colorado's 1st District. Hello, Senator.
Hello, Sarah.
And just to give our listeners some context, tell us a bit about your district, the 1st District of Colorado. Where is it and what's it like?
I have most of the eastern plains of Colorado. It's a very rural district that is primarily, the economy is based primarily on agriculture and energy production.
And you have two private and two public prisons within your district, Senator. How are those facilities similar and how are they different from each other?
Well, they're very similar in that, you know, and I've visited all of these as part of being a legislator for the area. So when you go into the facility, you really can't tell one from the other. They have the same educational programs. They have the same work programs. They have roughly the same staffing levels. The big difference is, of course, the employees at the private facilities are private employees. The employees at the state-owned facilities are you know, state of Colorado employees. The private facilities both pay property taxes to the local county, and so they support the school and they support a lot of the local county activities from a revenue standpoint. And in all cases, the facilities typically buy their utilities, you know, water and power and things like that from the city. So in both cases, publicly and private owned places, they both support the local infrastructure to a great degree.
And what about cost? I mean, how does that work out in terms of cost to the taxpayers?
You know, what's really interesting to me is that the average cost of holding a prisoner in the state facilities is around $78 to $79 per day. And the average cost, or well, what we pay the private facilities is about $53 to $54 a day. So we're getting a pretty good bargain for the prisoners that are held in the private facilities. Now, they don't hold the hardest guys to keep. You know, for instance, it's very rare that what we call administration segregation, which is the level of offender that's most dangerous, they're rarely put into the private facilities. They're not supposed to be at all. They're only supposed to hold the medium classification type folks. So they don't have the worst of the worst. But for what we use them for, I think they're a great bargain. And I think it's important for the taxpayers that we have this type of facility available.
So how are the private prisons managing to do it for less? What are they cutting?
You know, it's mostly labor. They have a slightly lower salary. And they don't have to contribute 20, we're about 22% now, and it's going up, or 20 now and going up to about 24% of salary is going into the Public Employee Retirement Association. The employees in the privately held facilities just contribute to Social Security, so their cost is down around 14% of salary as opposed to 20 and going up to 24% of salary. So they have a slightly lower salary and a less expensive benefits package.
You know, there have been some problems or concerns about private prisons, at least in other states like Ohio. A Cincinnati newspaper recently reported that the Lake Erie Correctional Institution there has dealt with fights, lockdowns, unsanitary conditions. That institution is also owned by CAA, which also owns the Kit Carson prison in your district. You know, are you worried about those kinds of issues? Are you worried about that organization's management?
You know, it everything bears watching, and I'm not terribly worried about it. But again, I don't trust anybody completely. So we have a verification system where we have state employees that go and look at the private facilities. Plus, they're accredited by some national organization that looks at both public and private facilities, and you can get a ranking on how well these places do. All the ones in Colorado are very highly accredited and very well run. Honestly, I don't see a difference between the facilities once you're inside. We've had prisoner problems in the public facilities and in the private facilities, both in Colorado. I mean, you are dealing with criminals, so you're not dealing with Boy Scouts.
And just philosophically, some people have a problem with the idea of someone making a profit off essentially misery. I mean, indirectly, you know, the victims have gone through misery, and prison is, of course, not a happy place. Is that the kind of thing that should be done for profit?
Yeah, and I've heard that argument too. But to me, it's interesting, and it's a little bit incomplete, because if that's your frame of mind, then the prisons should be staffed with completely volunteer workers, as opposed to somebody profiting from their labor by providing labor to the state-owned facilities. Because after all, you know, your payment for going to work is a return for your labor capital, and your profit is nothing but a return for your monetary capital. They're both part of an, you know, important incentives for people to, one, go to work, or two, invest money. So that line of reasoning I find to be incomplete. And in some cases, I think it's probably disingenuous, because I usually hear it from people that favor public employee unions. And of course, the state workers in Colorado are unionized now, and the private facility workers are not. And often then you find people making interesting lines of argument to protect union labor versus non-union labor. And I think that's what we see in this case. I don't see a difference between going to work for a paycheck or putting your money to work for a return on that investment.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, though, Senator, you're not just talking about workers within the prisons, though, right? I mean, with a private model, someone owns that institution and makes money off of being an owner of a prison.
Right. They hope to make money off of the capital that they have invested in building that facility and employing the people that work there. So that's a capitalistic system, and it's a return on their investment. Now, the people that go to work for a paycheck, whether in the private facility or in the public facility, are getting a return for their labor. And that's appropriate. That gives you an incentive to show up at work. If you're opposed to people profiting from holding prisoners, then you should also be opposed to labor profiting from guarding those prisoners. You should make the argument that the prisoners should be guarded with entirely volunteer labor instead.
And Senator Brophy, that's an issue we're going to talk about more later in the show, and I know your time is limited. One last question before I let you go. You said you've had a pretty good impression of the private prisons in your district, Colorado's first district. Would you like to see a move toward entirely privately run facilities in Colorado?
Oh, that's a great question. And I wouldn't mind that as long as we had, say, four providers to choose from. I'd be adamantly opposed to a completely private-run facility if we only had, say, two or three providers of private prisons in Colorado. I like having the ability to hold prisoners in state facilities and not be held hostage to a corporation, if they want higher rates, especially during a difficult budgeting time. I would not want to have all of our prisoners held by two or three private facilities. So I kind of like the mix that we have in Colorado right now with up to two private providers, although the other one that's in my district is currently holding prisoners from a different state. I mean, if California wanted to save a lot of money, they could easily contract with private prisons in Colorado and probably cut their cost of holding prisoners by, 50%.
So what you're talking about is almost a little bit of competition for the private prisons from the public sector, in a sense.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I just don't like the risk of you know, as important as it is to keep bad guys in jail or prison in this case. I don't want the risk of a private facility being able to hold us hostage for, let's say, a $10 per day prisoner increase if we didn't have the capacity to hold most or more of them ourselves in the state-run facilities. So I think we need to have a balance and a mix.
Okay, well, Senator, thank you so much for joining us. That was State Senator Greg Brophy of Colorado. His state has a mix of public and private prisons. I want to talk now a little bit more about how corrections vary across the country. So we're going to go now to Martin Horn, a distinguished lecturer at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. Hello, Professor Horn.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you? Thanks for being on the program.
Happy to do it.
You specialize in corrections policy. If you've been listening to this conversation, how typical is this Colorado model about an even split, at least in Senator Brophy's district, between public and private?
It's increasingly popular around the country, but I would not say it's the dominant model. Certainly, the use of private prison providers has taken hold over the last 30 years, but they don't house the majority of prisoners in this country.
And are we seeing this approach in other places? Are we seeing more of a move toward privatization?
I think that the move towards privatization has sort of reached its high watermark. The demand for the use of private prisons was greatest when prison populations throughout the nation were growing fast, and the rate of growth in the American prison population seems to be leveling off in the last 2 years. So states are not under the pressure that they once were. I don't think that private prisons will ever become the dominant model in American penology. I think it's a useful adjunct to a primarily publicly run prison system.
So a fast-growing prison population for some states, not Iowa, but some states, drove a move toward privatization. What has driven that leveling off in prison populations that you described?
You know, there are a lot of factors. Certainly, I think the most important of them is the aging out of the post-war baby boom. You know, the people who commit most crime are 18 to 25-year-old men, and the generation that was born between 1946, say, and 1951 turned 18 in 1968, 69, and that fueled the original crime problem that Richard Nixon was responding to, and then that was exacerbated by the introduction of heroin from the Far East during the Vietnam War, and it was fueled further by the introduction of crack cocaine in 1981. And as the population of 18 to 25-year-olds from that post-war generation aged out, the amount of crime they were committing diminished. At the same time, the use of drugs in the United States appears to have leveled off or receded. And many states have adopted policies to stem the growth in prison population. During the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s, states were passing very draconian laws, mandatory imprisonment requirements, lengthier prison terms, very restrictive parole release policies. And the cost of running prisons really was beginning to break the bank. So beginning really with the 2008 fiscal crisis, I think that states have turned away and are finding new ways to reduce their prison populations.
Yeah, and Professor Horn, as I mentioned, there are no private prisons in Iowa, but there are different emphases at different prisons, and some of them emphasize things like drug treatment, substance abuse treatment. I recently visited Mount Pleasant Correctional Facility in eastern Iowa, where most of the inmates are in some kind of treatment. Most of the sex offender treatment happens there. Do you see that in systems around the country, you know, how much is treatment being emphasized?
I think more and more, and in fact, Iowa, if the data on their website for the Department of Corrections is accurate, and I have no reason to believe that it's not, has actually been at the forefront of using what we refer to as evidence-based practices. These are approaches to working with incarcerated persons that are based on research and that have shown to have results, that are based on needs assessments, based on applying the proper kind of treatment approach to the offender, focusing on the high-risk offenders, using cognitive behavioral and social learning techniques. And so Iowa seems to be doing the right thing in terms of their approach to offender rehabilitation.
Is that a typical approach, or is that a new thing?
Well, it's new over the last 10 or 15 years. It's increasingly being adopted around the country. And Iowa is in a nice position because with only 8,000 to 9,000 inmates, it's manageable, and it appears that they've been able to implement it successfully.
You talk about
the other thing that Iowa has going for it is that the corrections department also controls the community corrections system, and so they can carry the forward the evidence-based practices once the offender completes his prison term and moves into the community.
You talk about evidence-based practices. That sounds good. Making decisions based on evidence makes a lot of sense, you would think. But what's the alternative? What has been done in the past?
Oh, in the past, I think people have been prone to fads. People believe that certain kinds of talking therapies worked. People have tried all sorts of different kinds of therapeutic approaches. I think also in the past, we gave the same treatment to all offenders, irrespective of the level of risk or need that they presented. And one of the most important teachings of the evidence-based practice movement has been to focus on those offenders who are at the highest risk of reoffending. And you get, so to speak, the greatest return on your investment by investing your resources on those people. And that's what Iowa appears to be doing.
So how do you know who those people are?
You use a validated risk assessment instrument. It's an actuarial tool, and based on what an offender has done in the past, the age at which he committed his first crime, the types of crimes he's committed, a variety of different social measures, you can assess people and determine, for example, that you are high risk and I am low risk based on what we have done in the past. The best predictor of our future behavior is what we have done in the past. And so we can predict who the high-risk offenders are going to be.
So, Professor Horn, aside from treatment, rehabilitation, another purpose of prison, in many people's minds, is to punish. Obviously, there are victims of these crimes, and to hold the perpetrators accountable for that. Do you think prisons are serving their purpose in that regard?
Absolutely. I think punishment is one of the things that prisons do best. They actually do a better job of punishment than they do of rehabilitation. And punishment is a perfectly valid social purpose for prisons. And there are people who are violent, who must be punished, and people who must be incapacitated, and that is a valid role for prisons. And certainly you have close to 700 people in Iowa who are serving mandatory sentences. You have 2,000 people who are in prison with mandatory minimums. I'm sorry, 700 with life sentences, 2,000 with mandatory minimums. So I think that the criminal justice structure in Iowa recognizes those purposes for imprisonment. But what we have to remember is 95% of the people who go to prison, even for punishment, eventually come home. And they're coming home to our communities, to the same communities that we took them from. And it is in our interest that when they come home, they be different people and they have different opportunities. And so we engage in rehabilitation, not for their benefit, but for our own. If we do nothing to change them and do nothing to change the odds that they can succeed in a lawful manner when they're released, we're the ones who are going to pay the price.
Given that we know that many, most offenders will come out.
95%, very few die in prison.
So how do we ensure public safety?
Well, I think through a variety of means. One certainly is incapacitation. We take people who are truly dangerous, repetitively dangerous, not controllable, and we lock them up for a long time until we believe they're no longer dangerous. That is a valid social role for prisons. Another thing that we do is that we impose punishment. We make prison, without making it inhumane, it is not intended to be a pleasant experience because we want to deter people. We want the offender to think twice before he does it again, and we want other people to think twice before they do it. And then while they're in prison, as I say, we try to change their behavior and change the odds so that they can succeed when they do return to the community. And we need to help them become successful law-abiding prisoners. The data in Iowa is very similar to the rest of the country. Most of the people you have in prison have underlying drug and alcohol problems. We have to address their addiction. We have to find ways to help them keep sober. If we don't, we know what the outcome is going to be. People who get out of prison need a job, so we need to teach them how to work. We need to teach them basic job skills in prison. And when they come out, we have to help them find work. And finally, they need a place to live. And in this day and age, I don't know what it's like in Iowa, but I know where I am in New York City, when a man comes out of prison, finding an affordable place to live, even if you have a minimum wage job in New York City, is nearly impossible. And if an individual is going to be living on a street or in a homeless shelter, they're very prone to getting back into their addictive behaviors. And if they get into their addictive behaviors, they're not going to be able to hold a job. And so the vicious cycle begins all over again. And who suffers? The victims of the crime, whether it's a burglary or robbery or a murder.
I hope that's an issue we can come back to in the second half of the show. But first, you know, you talk, Professor Horn, about punishment as a deterrent, keeping people from committing crimes, other people, in the first place. And you also talk about trying to change behavior once people are in prison. How much is punishment connected with rehabilitation? Do people sometimes need to be punished in order to see that they need to change?
You know, I don't think there's very much research on that. In fact, if you know, the things that I would do to punish someone are not the same things I would do to rehabilitate someone. I certainly don't think we should send people to prison simply for the purpose of rehabilitation. If all a person needs is rehabilitation, that is best done in the community. You know, you don't learn how to fly an airplane in a submarine, and you don't learn how to live in the community in prison. Prisons are artificial environments. I think the people who go to prison should be people who require incapacitation, people who we must punish in order to reinforce our social norms and keep faith with the victims and those people who we have to incapacitate because they're dangerous. But as I say, once we have them in prison, then at some point we have to begin that process of preparing them to return to the community since they are all coming home.
And if you'd stay with us, Professor Horn, we're going to talk more about these issues and others in the second half of the show. I have been talking with Martin Horn, a professor at John Jay College in New York, who specializes in corrections policy. It's part of our series this summer on corrections in Iowa. And coming up, we'll talk with Iowa corrections officials about how our system fits into this picture. That's coming up on River to River after the break. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. Hello, I'm Sarah McCammon, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. We're talking today about the purpose of prison as we continue our summer-long exploration of Iowa's correctional system. Today, we're looking at how Iowa fits into the national picture. My guests are Martin Horn, a criminal justice professor from John Jay College in New York, and joining me now, three guests from Iowa's Department of Corrections: Letty Prell, Research Director for the Department, Katrina Carter, Assistant Offender Services and Program Director, and Assistant Director Fred Scaletta. Hello, and welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Thanks to all of you for being here. We're kicking off our summer series, of course, on corrections today. And we'd also like to hear from you, our listeners, about the purpose of prison. What do you think it should be? Give us a call or comment on our Facebook page. Just search for Iowa Public Radio or on Twitter at IPR Talk. Any of those ways you can reach us. The phone number is 1-866-780-9100. Again, that's 866-780-9100. Now, first, a question for our guests who've just joined us from the Iowa Department of Corrections. As you've been listening to this conversation about how prisons look around the country, Letty Prell, I want to start with you. How would you say Iowa compares to some of the other models we've heard about and some of the other approaches out there?
We compare really well. Pew Center on the States did a state-by-state comparison of prison recidivism rates, you know, the likelihood of return to prison within 3 years of release. And Iowa, in that report, had the 13th lowest recidivism rate in that report. Nationally, the Pew Center on the States reported that the recidivism rate among these states was 43.3%. Iowa's that year was 33.9%, and now we're below 31% with our more recent data.
So how about this issue of treatment? How does that fit into the goal of reducing recidivism, and how do we know if those programs are effective?
We utilize our own in-state research. I go around and recruit or, you know, try to convince nationally recognized researchers and other academicians. Iowa State University has received a National Institute of Justice grant to study our offender reentry process. So we are actively engaged in getting research done on Iowa offenders. In addition, we've partnered with, we're a results first state with the Pew MacArthur Trusts, and we've implemented the results first model, which is a cost benefit model to see what the return on investment is with our prison based programs and also community corrections programs. So we know now that, and we can demonstrate that investing in substance use treatment in prison, in vocational education, in cognitive-based programming, and other programs are a bargain for Iowa taxpayers.
And Katrina Carter, also with the Department of Corrections, earlier on Talk of Iowa, some of our listeners were listening a couple hours ago as we kind of kicked off this series, you talked a lot about the shift toward more programming in prisons that focuses on rehabilitation. I mean, what drove that shift?
I think, honestly, the research drove the shift. You know, if you look back over history of corrections on how we used to do things and going into what works and looking at what other states and other people are learning, it just was making sure that we were keeping up with what was proven to work. And a lot of the research that we looked at came from Canada and things like that. But again, it's us wanting to be effective with our taxpayer dollars. And it's also us, I think, at our core of being Iowans is wanting to do the right thing. And earlier we were talking about punishment, and I, whenever I do any trainings, I talk about we are the Iowa Department of Corrections, not the Iowa Department of Penitence. And so I think our philosophy is that the punishment is the actual sentence that is handed down by the judge. And then when they are incarcerated, they really have time to work on themselves. And we have the programming that is backed by the evidence to change their thinking and behaviors. So again, when they are released, it will be safer for all of us.
Yeah, and on that note, I want to go now to a caller from Des Moines. Eric is on the line. Hello, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing excellent. I was just listening into the program and kind of really struck a chord with me because I did 14 months in the Iowa Correctional System, and everything was like, you know, going through all the treatments and being away from everybody and away from everything really gave me the opportunity to look at my life, where I was going, and it gave me the chance to change my attitude and just totally shift my view on life to where I am today. And it's, I mean, it was a complete 180. I mean, prison's not a fun place, but for me, it was exactly what I needed at the time. And I'm honestly thankful I got that opportunity, or else I'd be a lot worse off.
Eric, may I ask what got you there?
Basically, marijuana-related charges.
And did you go through any of the treatment programs we've been talking about while you were in prison?
Yeah, I was in NCCF, the North Central Correctional Facility, and I did substance abuse treatment there. Iowa Central Community College offered a program called Life Skills, and it was basically a six-week-long class on, we learned everything from doing resumes to interview skills. We did mock interviews with our prison warden, and I mean, that was probably one of the most beneficial things I ever did.
What's it been like transitioning, going back out with, of course, a criminal record?
For me, at first it was a little difficult. I'm one of the lucky ones who has, I just had a heck of a support team behind me, though, coming into this. And that's a big part of it. When you get out, I mean, if you don't have the support, it's really easy to fall back into those negative, the negativity. So that's a huge thing, is just having the right support behind you coming out.
What do you think you learned in prison that was most important in helping you succeed?
The most important thing to me was that I needed to be sober, because when I use drugs, I make horrible decisions and wind up away from my family. So that was the biggest thing. It's just, I needed to basically get my head out of my butt, and just, I really needed to focus on me and what was driving me to do the things I was doing.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Eric.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, our number for River to River is 1-866-780-9100. Again, this is River to River on Iowa Public Radio. What are your thoughts on the purpose of prison? Should it be about rehabilitation, or how much should it be about punishment and public safety? And how do those things come together? I'd like to go back to Professor Martin Horn. You were talking earlier this hour, Professor, about some of these issues about transitioning to life outside, something Eric just talked about, his own experience after serving 14 months in prison. And you talked about some of the challenges inmates face. What works, though, for helping them make that transition successfully? Who's doing it well?
Well, I think, you know, what works is the same thing that works in prison that our colleagues from the Department of Correction were talking about, and that is to use programs that have been proven by research to make a difference, evidence-based programs. So the first step is that as the offender is leaving the prison to return to the community, to continue that process of needs assessment. And I know in Iowa they do it when the inmate enters the system, and then they track the change in his risk and needs levels based upon his exposure to programs within the prison. And then when he's ready to leave prison, they know what his risk and need profile is. And again, by focusing on the highest risk, highest need offender, we get the greatest return for our efforts. I think that, as I've said, everyone who leaves prison, I think, needs a job, needs a place to live, and most importantly, for the vast majority of them, needs to stay sober, as your caller said. So we have to work on helping inmates learn how to stay sober while they're in prison, making sure that our prisons are drug-free and alcohol-free, so that when they leave prison, they are no longer addicted. And then we need to help them prevent relapse, enter into treatment, participate in AA programs, and stay sober. I think that's the single most critical element to promoting post-release success. We have to help them find jobs. Not everyone can find a job on their own. And we have to either reunite them with family or help them to find a place to live so that they're not living on the street corners.
You talk about the research-based approach again, and Katrina Carter, you touched on that as well when you were describing why Iowa made the shift toward a more rehabilitation-focused model. Was there something else? I mean, was there a problem you were trying to correct in Iowa's prison system by making that shift?
I think that not a problem per se, but our prison population was increasing, and we were seeing more folks coming back. And we just, again, wanted to make sure we were doing everything that we could to lower that recidivism. And what that entails is making sure that we have, once a person is involved with the criminal justice system, that's really where we believe reentry begins. If someone is on probation in the community, we have a very robust community-based corrections in our state, and much work goes on with probationer cases. And, you know, if we can keep people in their natural community, they are with all of their support systems, with family, with jobs, with, you know, AA or NA support groups, et cetera. And so what we were wanting is we just wanted to take all of that information and reducing that recidivism rate.
And as you made that shift, Katrina, in the Department of Corrections, I mean, what changed on a day-to-day basis, on a practical level? What looks different now?
Honestly, I think that, again, I stated this morning, I truly believe in the quality of staff that are employed by the Iowa Department of Corrections, both in the districts and in the institutions. I've been involved with corrections going on 14 years now, and truly, and I've said this nationally, it is the staff that are hired and retained and trained, and I think it, again, comes from our core values of being from Iowa, or just having that internal motivation to want to do the right thing and to treat others with respect, and just, you know, role modeling for offenders and showing folks how to be pro-social. So again, I firmly stand behind the staff that are employed by our correction system.
Sarah, may I interject at this point?
Of course, Professor.
I think it raises a very interesting point. When we go back to what Senator Brophy was saying and why the private prisons were so much less expensive, and he was talking about how much less they were able to pay their employees and how much less they were contributing to the pension systems or the benefit packages for their employees. You know, this is not a race to the bottom. As Katrina just said, the quality of personnel is critically important to the safety of our communities, to the quality of our prisons. And it seems to me that if we want good quality people, we need to pay them a good professional wage and give them good benefits. If we want to pay them, working a prison is not like working at a franchise burger place. And we don't want turnover. We want experience. We don't want people leaving. And the way you achieve that is by paying people a good wage. And I think that's one of the problems. Not all private prisons do that, but from what Senator Brophy was describing, I certainly don't think that is a sound approach.
We do have a question about private prisons from, and I think not just private, but also state prisons, about some of the costs inside prisons from a caller. David is in Des Moines. Hello, David. David, you calling from Des Moines?
Yes.
Yeah, what's your question?
My question was to the senator and some other individuals that might be involved. Why do they allow certain luxuries in prisons like cable TV, where that money that they get from the prisoners should probably be going towards these programs that are helping to rehabilitate people? And I don't understand, you know, like I was saying, prison is not supposed to be pleasant. And, you know, the money that they get from inmates could help to ease the strain on the employees that work there, and that extra money can go into those programs and services to help pay for the programs that help rehabilitate.
Well, let me direct that to the Iowa Department of Corrections staff. You know, David is asking about things like cable TV in prison. Do Iowa's prisons have cable TV, for instance?
Yes, this is Fred Scaletta, and I did answer this question earlier. There is cable TV in our prison systems. However, I do need to make it clear that there is no taxpayer dollars that fund these cable resources. They are funded through the additional charges in commissaries. When inmates buy commissary items, there's a charge that's added on to that, and that pays for the cable TV. And again, the cable TV, it really helps for people who are in prison. Their time every day is not totally occupied for a whole day's length and education and work assignments and those types of things. So there's plenty of free time, and this is an opportunity for them to be have some of that time taken up and keep them entertained, so to speak, as opposed to out doing, you know, non-productive things and, you know, possibly getting into other types of problems within the institution. So, again, it's not a taxpayer-funded thing, and, again, it helps provide some entertainment and some things for them.
Thank you for that. And I had one last question. Now, what are they going to do with the repeat offenders? I mean, like the really, really bad ones that they just don't get it. It's like they release those individuals and they go back out in the community and they do it again, and then they get back in the prison system and then they go back out in the community and do it again. I'd like to see something happen with some intervention about that, because the ones that are repeat offenders and they continuously go into the system and then they go back out in the community and do it again, those are the offenders that really we need to focus on more.
Okay, and Letty Prowl, I'm thinking as the researcher there at the Department of Corrections, you might have some data on repeat offenders. How often do we see the kinds of offenders that come back again and again?
Like I said, our recidivism rate is under 31% now. So in any given year, the offenders that we release, fewer than one-third will return to prison within 3 years. And that's a pretty favorable rate. Now, you know, we would love to, you know, work for it to become zero. When people are in prison and they are not motivated to go into treatment and their attitude is bad and they are involved in disciplinary actions or gang activity inside the prison system, those are not people that we would recommend for release. Those offenders may discharge their sentences. You know, if they weren't sentenced to a lot of time, they may discharge their sentences and be released from prison with no supervision. And those are, you know, that will happen if someone isn't motivated. But that's, you know, just we need to redouble those efforts. And I'd also like to see us take a look at doing what we can to break this generational pattern within some families toward crime. You know, I've been in studying the system for over 30 years, and you know, I saw the dad, and now we're seeing the sons, and then they're having kids, and we're wondering, well, you know, we'll probably see them in the future. What can we do to break this cycle?
I think one of our callers has some thoughts about that, and we just have a couple of minutes, but I want to go briefly to James in Des Moines. Hello, James.
Good afternoon. Yes, if we're looking to successfully rehabilitate these folks, we can't saddle them with debt, and while it may not seem huge to us, regular wage earners or income earners, it's huge to them when they're working in low-paying jobs, minimum wage, maybe a little above minimum wage, and they're sending a huge chunk of that back to the court for restitution, court costs, supervision fees, change of custody, you know, the list goes on and on and on, when what we really ought to be doing is, in order to break this familial cycle, is to teach them how to be parents, allow them to go back out with the support system of the probation and parole officer without a debt, and work to support their families. I think anything other than that is short-sighted. If we wanted more money for schools, roads, and bridges, we ought to quit building prisons and concentrate on keeping the people in there who need to be in there, and the people who need to come out, get them out, with the support and the preparation that they need to be successful.
Well, thank you for those thoughts, James. And just in about half a minute or so, Martin Horn, that touches on a lot of things that you've spoken about earlier. How often are people leaving prison saddled with a lot of financial obligations they can't meet?
It's quite frequent, and one of the other issues is child support. So many men in particular leave prison with enormous child support debt. And while no one suggests that it be forgiven, I think we have to find ways to work out reasonable payment schemes so that this enormous debt does not become a disincentive to find work because their wages will be garnished. So we don't want to create these kinds of barriers to rehabilitation and reentry through misguided efforts to hold offenders accountable. We want to hold them accountable, but we have to do it in an intelligent fashion.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Martin Horn of John Jay College in New York, and thanks also to our guests Letty Prell, Katrina Carter, and Fred Scaletta of the Iowa Department of Corrections. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had tech assistance today from Julie Englander and John Pemble. Our theme music is composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Sarah McCammon. Ben Kiefer will be back next week with more on prisons. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.